From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what roadblocks remain for the new bridge from Detroit to Windsor?
The lawsuits are probably the main obstacle out there right now. The Bruins have failed to stop it so far, but they're still pursuing litigation in both Canada and the United States.
Plus, taking aim at the sea lamprey.
In the Great Lakes, they didn't evolve here, they don't belong here, and they're devastating to the native fish population.
Are we blaming too many problems on student debt? One analyst says yes.
So we want people to be cognizant of the trade-offs they make when they take on debt, but we don't want people to be afraid of it in a way that's not justified.
And an insider's look at life on Mackinac Island.
I'm always amazed because there's so many people who live in Michigan who never have actually been to Mackinac, and then they go up there and they say, wow, we really missed something.
Student debt in America. It's larger than total credit card debt or car loan debt, and it's growing fast. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, as college students head back to campus, we look at the long-term effect of debt and whether big debt burdens really pay off down the road. But first, we haven't seen any huge headlines of late about the proposed new bridge between Detroit and Windsor, but it doesn't mean things aren't buzzing away behind the scenes. For one thing, the Canadians have chosen the team who will actually build the new international trade crossing bridge. The Detroit Free Press' John Gallagher has been looking at the progress and obstacles for the new bridge to Windsor. John, first to the progress. Tell us about this team Canada has chosen to build the bridge.
Okay, well, they've hired a man named Michael Cotillo, who is the CEO of the project, sort of the ramrod of the whole thing. He's a professional engineer by training from Toronto, and he has spent most of his career with the Ontario Minister of Transportation doing building expressways and that kind of thing. So he's very well qualified. As of a couple of weeks ago, he took up his new office in Windsor, and he's hiring his team. He'll be hiring 40 or 50 staffers to help him, and they'll be putting out bids and hiring contractors and eventually, you know, setting tolls sometime down the road for the new bridge. So the thing which has up to now been sort of a political question, is it going to happen? That's more or less been settled, and now we're in the early stages of, well, who's going to do it? How do we hire them? When do bids go out? All that kind of stuff.
And so we've got that important piece of the puzzle in place. We still have Governor Snyder certainly solidly behind the new bridge and the Canadian government. But I'm wondering, can the progress toward this bridge withstand any changes in those players, regime changes, if you will?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the main obstacle, I suppose, are probably the lawsuits that the Maroon family, owner of the Ambassador Bridge, which is opposing this new bridge because it'll cost them a lot of business. The lawsuits are probably the main obstacle out there right now. The Maroons have failed to stop it so far, but they're still pursuing litigation in both Canada and the United States on a variety of fronts. You know, you never know if they might win one of those. But beyond that, if somehow there's a change of leadership in either Canada or in Michigan, if Governor Snyder loses, would that make any difference? And I think that's an unknown. I think the answer is probably not. I think the project is both viewed as too important by everybody, as well as too far along at this point with legal contracts signed, you know, for people to sort of back out of it. But, you know, you never know. If there's a major national recession, if the Canadian authorities decide they're spending too much money on this, I mean, who knows? It's always possible until that first traffic is crossing the bridge. It's always sort of, you know, what if?
Well, John, let's circle back, if you will, to Maddie Maroon. And as in your piece for the Free Press, one lawyer told you that this Ambassador Bridge owner is not going to let this bridge happen without, in his words, fighting like a dog. Is there anything new in this fight besides a lot of billable hours for Maddie Maroon's lawyers?
Right. Well, I guess the next stage would be that MDOT, Michigan Department of Transportation, has to start buying land on the Detroit side to build the approaches to the bridge and also where the federal inspection plaza will come, where cars and trucks are inspected. And Maddie Maroon owns some land down there. And, you know, the state law on seizing land for public infrastructure is pretty clear. He could still make a fuss. He could still, you know, fight that. He would probably lose that one because, as I said, the law is pretty clear on the ability of the government to seize that land. But, you know, there's a whole variety of ways he can try to fight it or delay it. So that's probably the next one. He's got some environmental lawsuits going in Canada. In Washington, D.C., he's fighting just the basic premise of the government granting a permit for this bridge. You know, the lawsuits take a long time. They'll be fighting these for a long time. But as I said, he's unlikely to prevail, but he might. I mean, it's not impossible to think that he might.
And then there's that, let's say, awkward matter of the United States, the Obama administration not coughing up the $250 million to build a new customs plaza. What is new with that?
Senator Levin, Senator Stabenow, John Dingell, you know, the other members of the Michigan delegation are lobbying hard to get the government to commit to this. The problem is, of course, is that the total cost of the bridge itself is about $1 billion, and that would include the, you know, the connection to I-75 and the Customs Plaza. And of that, Canada is fronting all the money except for the U.S. Customs Plaza. And if the U.S. government does not agree to pony up and pay for that, the alternatives are a little weird. I mean, Canada could agree to pay for it up front, but it's yet one more piece of the sort of the U.S.-Michigan obligation that Canada's agreed to front. And that creates some bad feelings and makes perhaps Canada less willing to make concessions to Michigan on issues that are important, like naming the bridge, for example. You would think that a name should appeal to both Michiganders as well as Canadians. Well, if Canada is just paying for everything, including the U.S. Customs Plaza, maybe they could just say, well, we'll just name it whatever we want and not even consult you guys. You know, it could create some bad feelings. So what's happening is that the delegation and Governor Snyder are working hard to get the U.S. federal government to commit to this, but it's still up in the air.
And bottom line, how confident, John Gallagher, are the major players that we will be driving over that new bridge by that target date of 2020?
The major players, the governor, the leaders of Canada, all say it's 100%. My view as a journalist looking at this and covering it for a long time is probably about 80%. I would say it's probably going to be built, but there are these lingering possibilities out there that something could get in the way. I think the number and the seriousness of the roadblocks is diminishing, but it's still not quite a done deal.
Detroit Free Press business writer John Gallagher, always a pleasure talking with you, John. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The sea lamprey is a blood-sucking, eel-like invasive species living in the Great Lakes. Beginning tomorrow, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will begin to apply lamprey-killing pesticides into the Muskegon River system. Michael Tuohy is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Michael, first remind us just what is a sea lamprey and why do we not want them in our waters?
Well, sea lampreys are fairly anciently evolved fish. They're native to the North Atlantic Ocean, and they spend most of their life in their larval form in tributary streams. But at some point, they mature, they metamorphose, drift downstream, and enter a short parasitic phase where they feed on larger fish. And that works out fine in the North Atlantic Ocean. But these animals got into the Great Lakes, the Upper Great Lakes, about 1920. They got around Niagara Falls when we built the Welland Canal. After that, we found their numbers proliferated in the Upper Great Lakes, and they devastated the fishery. The fishery just plummeted. Lake trout disappeared from the lower lakes, and many other fish are gone from this earth forever. So that's the problem with sea lampreys. They belong in the North Atlantic Ocean. It's a great big pond with a relatively low ratio of spawning streams to ocean area. But in the Great Lakes, they didn't evolve here. They don't belong here. And they're devastating to the native fish populations.
And in looking at photos of them, the array of teeth that they have that can penetrate the scales and the skin of a fish as it looks for the blood, they're very prehistoric looking.
They're a very efficient fish eating machine. Each one consumes about 40 pounds of lake trout in its lifetime. Its parasitic phase lasts about a year and a half, and then they find a stream to spawn in. And then they die, much like a salmon would. But then the larvae live in those streams, filter feeding, not really hurting anything. But then they eventually metamorphose and complete the life cycle.
And thus, the sea lamprey killing that's planned for the Muskegon River system, you're zeroing in on those larvae?
Exactly. And that's kind of the backbone of the program. You know, since about 1960 or so, late 50s, early 60s, we discovered this chemical called TFM. And it's a remarkably benign chemical to most other creatures. So we're very fortunate. We put this in a river in which larval lampreys are present, and it will kill the sea lamprey larvae and largely leave everything else intact. It degrades quite readily in the environment.
So what are we seeing happening this month?
Well, the Muskegon River will be getting treated. The Muskegon River is the largest producer of sea lampreys to Lake Michigan. So there's probably almost 5 million larvae in that river right now. So if it went untreated, over 100,000 parasites would be produced there annually. And, you know, and at about 40 pounds of Great Lakes fish being destroyed per animal, that would amount to over 4 million pounds of Great Lakes fish. And we just can't have a sustainable fishery without a sea lamprey control program to knock these numbers down.
Michael, do we ever see a day where we will be rid of these things, or we're just going to have to kind of keep this kind of system going of trying to kill off these the larvae?
You know, I'm optimistic. I think that we will have a means of eradicating them. Right now, the philosophy is to treat to some economic injury level. You know, we can afford to spend a certain amount of money and we gain a great deal of economic benefit. This fishery is worth over $7 billion, has a great cost-benefit ratio, this program. But we've got all kinds of really cool research going on pheromones, alarm substances, and I personally think that some of the genetic type of work that's going on, that we will find a silver bullet here and be able to eradicate these animals from the Great Lakes.
Michael Tuohy, fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we spoke to him from Mackinac City. Michael, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And here at Michigan Radio, Rebecca Williams of the Environment Report has done a huge amount of lamprey coverage, including a very serious report on a killer lamprey film. That's when residents of a fictional Michigan town battle the lamprey. It's called Blood Lake, Attack of the Killer Lampreys, brought to you by, yes, the very same people who made Sharknado. You can watch a trailer on the website michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says the Environment Report. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You just never know what that summer job during college just might lead to. Dennis Cawthorn's summer job in 1960 found him on Mackinac Island, standing on the street, enticing tourists into horse-drawn wagons. That job opened up an entirely new world to Cawthorn and led to some 50 years of living and working on Mackinac Island. Dennis has been a state legislator, a lawyer, the chairman of the Mackinac Island State Park Commission, and much more. His new book is Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Dennis Cawthorn, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here and glad to be telling folks about Mackinac Island.
Now, you had never even set foot on Mackinac before you took that summer job in 1960?
Well, I think I'm like a lot of people in Michigan. You know, we live close to Mackinac, as I did. I lived in Manistee, which is on the shores of Lake Michigan, but I had never been to Mackinac until I had the opportunity to work there as a college student. And I'm always amazed because there's so many people who live in Michigan who never have actually been to Mackinac, and then they go up there and they say, wow, we really missed something.
So, why do you think it is, Dennis, that so many people, I mean, just looking at your own family's experience and as you found so many people, it's there, but they don't make the trip up. What do you think keeps them from doing that?
Well, I think, you know, the idea that it is an island actually in some people's mind creates a bit of a barrier, but of course it's, you know, a 20-minute trip by boat. And I think a lot of people have a perception that it's kind of expensive, which it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, there are a lot of good, reasonably priced places to stay, a lot of good, reasonably priced restaurants. So it doesn't have to be expensive. But I think, you know, that is some of the reasons some people kind of hesitate about making that trip.
And then they get there and go, wait a minute, there's so much more. Tell us first about, I loved your recounting of that first job, because you actually did find yourself in a stable mucking out the horse stalls, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I went up there, as I say in the book, because I had this vision of being a carriage tour driver, you know, extolling the virtues from a dinky seat of the island's beauty. And I had visions of, you know, handing out the suckers to little kids whose parents would be very grateful and would therefore tip appropriately. What I found out was that the job involved a lot more than that. I had to muck out the stables, had to put bits in slobbering mouths, and I quickly decided that maybe being a carriage loader was a better job than being a tour driver of one of the carriages.
And that might be the kind of thing that would make you say, you know, I'm going to do something different going forward for my summer jobs. But what was it about Mackinac that drew you back, that made this something more than a typical summer job?
Well, you know, Mackinac obviously is a very beautiful place, very historic place, but the thing that drew me then and fascinates me to this day are the people who are the heart and soul of the island. The island's people are a lot different than you might imagine. In fact, in the book, we quote one gentleman who said that Charles Dickens would have a hard time matching the characters that you will find on Mackinac. So that there's just a lot of character and a lot of characters. The island's traditional culture was that of French Indian. The French Indian influence always was and still is, you know, quite important on the island. And the other component are the Irishmen who settled the island in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s. And, you know, those two groups formed a unique cultural foundation for the island. And there's just a lot of interesting things that came out of that. And there's just a ton of interesting people who, you know, make up the island. So I think it was the people that really provided the big draw, and it's one of the focuses of my book.
I'm talking with Dennis Cawthorn. His book is Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal, where he began with a summer job in 1960 on Mackinac Island and has opened up 50 years of living and working on Mackinac, from the Chamber of Commerce manager to saloon keeper, restaurateur, legislator. When and how did Mackinac Island become Mackinac Island, from, you know, a place where a small number of people lived, this island, to the Mackinac Island that is such a tourist draw?
You know, way back, even the Native Americans thought that Mackinac Island was a holy place. It was also their great gathering spot. There was something about the island that attracted even the Native Americans, and they viewed the island as like a great turtle rising out of the sea, and so the name Michilimackinac roughly translates into the great turtle. But then, say in the 1840s, you had a lot of writers who came to the island and were fascinated by it. But it was really beginning in the late 1870s, 1880s, that tourism, mainly by big steamer boat, became a focal point on the island. And so it was that period when tourism really took off and was the beginning of what Mackinac now is, a great tourist magnet.
Has it been a tough challenge through the decades, Dennis Cawthorn, to preserve the charm that brings visitors to the island, but yet ushering it into the 21st century?
Yes, very much so. For example, you know, the island has a ban on automobiles, and that dates back to 1898. But in the book, we recount many of the battles that took place to, you know, preserve the auto ban. And in one respect, it has not been preserved perfectly, because in the 1970s, the local population during the winter felt very, very isolated, very, very immobile. They put a lot of pressure on the city council and the state park commission to permit snowmobiles. So finally, the state park commission, and this was before I was member and chairman, finally threw up its hands and said, okay, we are going to allow snowmobiles in certain parts of the island. And so the ban on motorized vehicles, you know, has been tinkered with, has been modified somewhat, and it's been a big battle to keep the whole thing intact, but I'm pretty confident the auto ban, as we know it today, will continue going forward.
Dennis, share with us, if you will, what's your favorite secret spot, something that because you're such an insider and you've been a part of the island life for so many decades, that if somebody was coming for a weekend or a few days, they might not see, but they should?
Yeah, there's a place called Sunset Rock, sometimes called Chimney Rock. If you look on a map, sometimes it says Sunset Rock, sometimes it says Chimney Rock. It's a very high outcropping on the west side of the island. It looks out toward the Mackinac Bridge, toward Round Island, toward St. Ignace. It's very high up and just has magnificent views. And you access it by going up to the Stonecliff Mansion. And then you proceed to the west or toward the lake from the Stonecliff Mansion. You'll see a path there that will take you to it. That's just a great spot. And Arch Rock on the opposite side of the island, much better known, is also, you know, spectacular. But Sunset Rock has the charm of being kind of hidden and you know, kind of unknown by most people.
Dennis, what do you think tourists and visitors do not know about life on Mackinac Island that you are trying to tell them through your book?
Well, that it's a very close-knit community with, again, a lot of real characters, kind you don't find in everyday suburban America. People who are colorful, and there's been a lot of speculation as to why the island breeds these colorful characters. But certainly that's it. And you know, the fact that, there is so much going on that's sort of behind the scenes. In the book, we talk about a lot of the political maneuverings that have occurred on the island, affecting the whole state, by the way. And we talk about some of the great controversies up there, such as the controversy over leasing state lands for private cottages, such as whether or not to expand the airport, and the current controversy involving the three ferry lines. And so there's just a lot of interesting, you know, behind-the-scenes maneuvering, much of it, you know, having a statewide impact. So it isn't just, you know, local stuff. It really has a statewide and perhaps even wider impact.
And it certainly opens the curtains a little for us to get a sense
opening
of what it's like.
Is an excellent phrase. I think that's what the book does. It's a behind-the-scenes look at what Mackinac is really all about. And I have to say, and if I can brag for just a second, I have had many island people tell me that they literally could not put the book down because they thought it captured the real island, the real essence, so well.
And I would suspect, from what I could tell in reading your book, they wouldn't hesitate to let you know if you blew it.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it amazes me that I've had such unanimity on that point of view, because as we indicate in the book, there's always a good controversy to be had on the island. So yeah, I'm quite pleased about the great response that it's had locally.
The book is Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. And we've been talking with the author, Dennis Cawthorn. It's been a pleasure, Dennis. Thank you for taking us to Mackinac Island.
Thank you. My pleasure. And come up to Mackinac soon.
What's the first image that comes to mind when I say the words balloon sculpture? For me, it's a pirate sword, or maybe a wiener dog made by a clown at a kid's birthday party. But when you look at the balloon creations by artist Tim Thurmond of Brighton, all of that goes right out the window. Tim is the balloon sculptor. His work has just been featured in the newest edition of Ripley's Believe It or Not Reality Shock Book, and Tim's in the Guinness Book of World Records. Tim Thurmond, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, people do not make themselves into the Guinness Book by making wiener dogs. So
no.
Describe a typical Tim Thurmond piece.
Well, that's just it. There is nothing typical about what I do. What I like to do is what blows people's minds. I mean, some of my pieces are 12 feet tall with 18-foot wingspans. I've done one mine feather dragon that was 43 feet in length with wings that reached about another 15 feet. I've done TARDIS from the Doctor Who show. A lot of the stuff I do is just to blow people's minds. My goal is to show people that balloons can be an art form. For so long, it's been a toy, and that's all people see it as, is a toy. I'm on a mission to show people that it can be taken seriously.
Well, Tim, it's not exactly like you can take balloon sculpting as an elective in 11th grade. So how and when did you discover this? How'd you learn?
It was actually right before my 9th birthday. Someone in my school said, hey, at a local church, they're doing a clown school. Why didn't you go? So I went into it, got into clowning. A couple weeks later, after I got into it, my dad started joining. So we started doing it as a family event. My mom joined about 6 months later. We had a lot of fun. We did a lot of cool stuff. A lot of great opportunities opened up, including able to go to Russia in 1993. But I realized when I got back from Russia, clowning really wasn't my thing. You can't fake being that happy. And I love what I do. I enjoy myself. But at the same time, after clowning for 2 hours, massage your face for about a half an hour because your cheeks are hurting so much from smiling, it just wasn't my thing. So right when I was about to give it all up, a magician friend of the family said, hey, next week there's a magic camp for teenage boys to learn how to be used to creative arts in their communities. Why don't you go? So I went. I mean, I'm 13 years old, a week away from the folks. Why not? You know? And during this week, you know, we learned all types of stuff like magic, chalk art, balloons, ventriloquism. And all those things were cool, but they really weren't me until the last day, which was balloons. You could go to the beginner class, advanced class. I sat down in the beginner class. Even though I'd already been doing balloons for 5 years, I didn't catch it. Well, the guy who ran the camp for over 20 years, he was in his late 70s at the time, picked me up by the back of the neck, pushed me in the advanced room, said, have fun. The next year, I taught the advanced class. I had great mentors who saw my potential, including one gentleman in Indiana who just got back from England where he won second place in an international balloon competition. He worked with me for a week, said what I'd learned in less than 6 months took him over 6 years. And with his thumbs up,
off you went.
Yeah, everyone wanted to be a part of what they thought my legacy would be. And I've had great mentors who didn't try to make a clone of themselves. they just try to teach me the techniques to give me the best chance possible to let me do my own thing. And then after that, it's just been having fun.
And what are you in the Guinness Book of World Records for?
The most balloons ever blown up by mouth and made in animals in 3, 6, 10, and 24 hours. Now, all four of those were previous held records. To give you an idea, I beat the 10-hour record within about 6 hours, the 6-hour record by about 3 hours, and the 3-hour record by over 500 balloons, and I beat the 24-hour record by over 2,000 balloons. Now, to give you an idea how dramatic that is, about 9 years ago, I originally set the record for the most balloons in 24 hours. I did 6,176.
And this is just standing there blowing up balloons.
Yep, making blowing up balloons and making a simple animal. You couldn't do the same thing twice in a row. You had to do a total of 30 different things. Well, after I did it, it took 9 years almost before someone else tried to challenge me because everyone thought the number was just unbeatable. Well, a guy called me up from Texas and said, hey, I'm going to go for your record. What can you tell me? I actually worked with him for about 2 months, talked about on the phone for about 8 hours total to teach him everything that I had learned while doing the record and since. And when he did his attempt, he beat me by 55 balloons. That's it. After everything I taught him and everything I had learned from personal experience and gave to him, he only beat me by 55 balloons. So he called me up 2 days later and go, I know you can do that better than that in your sleep. I can't advertise it until I know that I really have it. I'm like, okay. So got some friends together and we went for it and beat, you know, his record by over 2,000.
So clearly you are doing what was done for you, which was you got that helping hand mm-hmm. when you wanted to learn the Fellowship of Christian Magicians.
Yes.
So you're extending the helping hand to those who want to learn now.
Oh, yeah. Whenever I get an opportunity to teach at a conference, I try to teach at least one conference a year. If I get a chance, 2 or 3. Because the art form can only grow if more people are pushing it. If you only have 5, 10 in the country or the world really pushing it, it only can go so far. You know, what really helps art is when you have masters of their craft who, of whatever era and whatever form, who are really pushing themselves. I mean, and that's the same in sports or anything else. You know, when you just have a Michael Jordan, it's Michael Jordan. But when you have someone like Kobe and then LeBron pushing each other, then you get the storylines. And the same thing with this form of artwork. When it's just one person doing it, it's, oh, that's cool, next. Mm-hmm. But when you have 2, 3, 20 of them who are always pushing, you're going to push the art form much, much quicker.
Now, when you say art form, too, I can tell you would really like the balloon to be seen as the same kind of medium that any other artist would mm-hmm. work in.
Definitely. I mean, I was very fortunate. A couple years ago, I got approached by the Grand Rapids Museum to do a piece inspired by Da Vinci. So I got to do The Last Supper. It was 20 feet long. I mean, we had the table was made out of balloons, the people were made out of balloons, the food was made out of balloons, and as everyone likes to comment, the feet were made out of balloons. Everything was made out of balloons. It took 40 hours. I had a couple guys from other states help me because the museum wanted it all done in one day. And it was a great project, and I'd love to do more museum projects because, to me, that's how people start taking it seriously.
And you can make a living as a balloon artist?
It's hard, and I won't say you make a great living, but you get by. And it's getting to a point where I've gotten to a good reputation, but I'm also getting ready to do a career change. Well, I still do balloons, but I'm going back to some of my roots.
Such as?
I'm actually a youth ministry. My background is actually as a children's pastor, and so I actually just got offered a job out of state to go and do that full-time and help a very unique program get started. So, but again, the balloons will always be a part of what I am and what I do, and I'll still do several big events each year to keep pushing the art form.
Well, you can see a gallery of Tim's work on his website. You can go to theballoonsculptor.com. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of stumbling upon you at the Rochester Art and Apples, and I took a video, and that will also be up on our website for everybody to see. So great to meet you. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Late last month, we spoke with Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny. He reported that a Pennsylvania oil and gas company planned to ship up to 36 tons of low-level radioactive waste from fracking to a landfill in Wayne County, near Belleville. That news led Governor Snyder to assemble a panel of experts to take a close look at the state's regulations for this waste, known as T-Norm. And it sparked a bipartisan reaction. Republican State Senator Rick Jones and Democratic State Representative Diane Slavens both proposed bills to ban the importing of radioactive fracking waste. Well, now Keith Matheny's been looking at the track record of the proposed dumping ground of this radioactive sludge. Keith is with us now. Recap for us, Keith, just who owns this Wayne Disposal Landfill?
It was owned for years by a company known as EQ, the Environmental Quality Company, but it was purchased in June by U.S. Ecology, which is a major waste management company. The two sites in question there at the location between the Willow Run Airport and I-94 are Wayne Disposal, which is the actual landfill, and they also have a processing facility on site, Michigan Disposal, Inc., where they process the hazardous waste that comes in and put it in a state where it's eligible, I guess, to be put in the landfill.
As you tell us in your story in Sunday's Free Press, the company, U.S. Ecology, is offering reassuring words about the safety, the security, and the compliance of these two operations. What did your review of the records find?
Well, we've heard repeatedly that this site is licensed and designed for this type of waste, and so we wanted to take a look at what its history was, and so I reviewed records of at both the state level, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the federal level, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and we found kind of a litany of violations going back to the 80s, actually, but if you just focus on the past decade or so, at least 15 violations in the past decade, fined more than $471,000. Both state and federal, and this is for things such as a breach of the primary protective liner of the hazardous waste landfill, toxic leachate spills. This is the liquid that kind of eventually flows through the hazardous waste and picks up some of the constituents of it. They have a leachate management system that on multiple occasions has leaked, and on a couple of occasions, because a worker at the surface breached the line, you know, with a digger or some sort. There have also been a number of fires at the location as they mix hazardous materials. There's some sort of a chemical reaction that causes a fire, some of them rather dramatic, actually.
And you also found that they have been cited for disposing of this hazardous waste in non-hazardous landfill locations.
Right, at least one instance where because they didn't properly treat the leachate that they then included in a non-hazardous waste fill landfill location, they were essentially putting hazardous waste in an area that wasn't designed for hazardous waste.
And I know the company spokespeople said to you that the operation has never jeopardized the health of the public or the environment. But as you tell us in your story, U.S. Ecology is also asking the DEQ to improve an increase in the radiation limit for TNORM.
Right. No, if you recall from our earlier conversation, TNORM is technologically enhanced, naturally occurring radioactive material. This is the stuff that kind of accumulates through processes such as fracking and concentrates to a level that's still quite low in radioactivity, but it's above the natural ambient radioactivity. Right now, Michigan's practice is that it comes into Michigan Disposal and it is treated, it is blended with inert materials to get it down to a level of radioactivity that's 50 picocuries or less. That's a measurement of radiation. They are asking the state to approve them to only have to reduce it to 500 picocuries or less. Now, they'll point to a U.S. Department of Energy study back in the 1990s that says it would be appropriate up to 2,000 picocuries or less. But I still think that's a conversation that the public and probably lawmakers here are going to want to have, as many already seem to have a problem with the fact that we're becoming a dumping ground for other states. Low-activity radioactive waste.
So even as the company says, well, we'll put plans on hold to allow the dumping of TNORM until the governor's panel is done, it's asking the state to increase the amount of radiation of this TNORM by tenfold.
Right, and it is not, that process has not stopped. It's actually waiting on the DEQ to finish some of its own studies to determine, you know, whether they want to agree to that or not. You mentioned that they've said that at no time have they ever exposed the public to anything potentially harmful in the activity of this landfill. There are a couple of instances in the records I went through where the DEQ notes, like during these fires, for example, and when I talk about fires, some of them are just like little small, they describe it as almost like a candle flame in the mixing tanks where they're putting all this hazardous material, on up to a fire in 2005 that burned for 3 days and forced the evacuation of 900 homes in the area. And in a couple of these fires, the DEQ notes that there was smoke emanating from the facility that was not controlled. So I would imagine you think about what could potentially be in hazardous waste smoke. That's troublesome.
Keith Matheny, Detroit Free Press, as always. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you, Cynthia.
New federal data shows Washington now holds more than $1.1 trillion in student loans taken out by nearly 40 million people. And that dollar amount, it's up by more than 112% since 2007. But should student debt get blamed for a wide range of economic troubles? Beth Akers says perhaps not. Akers is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Education Policy. Beth, what kinds of economic problems are being blamed on student debt?
Oh, gosh, a whole host of things here. A lot of the narrative is about how student loan debt is potentially creating a huge drag on the economy through reduced consumption. A lot of that is coming through what's happening with home purchasing among young households.
So depressed home ownership is getting blamed, and lower rates of entrepreneurship as well.
Yeah, so that's part of the narrative as well. People are also imagining that there may be a relationship with household formation. People are staying in their family homes longer, which is really a separate issue even from the home purchasing issue, but that just co-residing with parents and then maybe even delaying their own family formation in terms of marriage and having their own children.
So a lot of blame being aimed at student debt, but in a sense kind of a scapegoat, as you say in your paper, for nearly all that ails the U.S. economy. Why do you believe and why do you say it's hard to back that blame up?
Sure. So, you know, this is a really difficult question to answer, like so many in social policy, because really we want to know what would be the outcome if we didn't have this debt, right? So we're looking at a counterfactual that we just absolutely can never measure. And so we have to be really sophisticated in the way we think about measuring these effects. The sort of simple way to do it, and really the only thing we can do when we can't run experiments, is to look at how do people with debt compare to people without debt. The problem with that, as is the problem all the time in these types of research questions, is that people who don't have debt for a reason. And that's that they look very different on a number of dimensions from the people who end up with debt. So when we compare across those two groups of households or two groups of individuals, we see very different outcomes. Some of that may be due to the fact that one group has student loan debt and the other doesn't. But the difference in outcomes are probably due to a lot of the other differences between these groups. For instance, you'd expect students from very wealthy households not to take on student loan debt and from less wealthy households to take on student loan debt. So the fact that these two groups have differences in outcomes in terms of when they purchase their homes is sort of not a surprising thing. And since we can't completely control for all the differences between these two populations, it makes it very, very challenging to really pin down what is the effect that student loan debt is having. So we're having a lot of discussions based on some preliminary analysis, and my fear is that we've really overstated the evidence that we have to draw this conclusion that debt is dragging down the economy, and sort of overlooked the fact that debt is also a tool that's allowed people to obtain a lot more education than they would have otherwise.
So we tend to perhaps not focus on the positive side of the student loan issue, as opposed to focusing very intensely on all these problems.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, really what we want to know is what is the net effect of this debt, right? The positive comes from the fact that it enables people to access more education, which leads to a greater investment in education on a national level and really leads to increase in domestic production. We have greater GDP because of all this investment. Are there effects on the other end and that people have less cash to spend? You know, potentially people bear a psychic cost of carrying this debt and that causes them to reduce consumption. And those are real effects as well, but it all needs to be calculated together to understand the effect. And you're right, people are really emphasizing the cost, but not the benefits of student loan debt.
It seems like to try to back up all of this and do this in the right scientific way, as you said, we need to have a control for these differences. It might be impossible. I mean, if we're talking about a 25-year-old who's graduating with a large amount of debt, who knows how that college education and that debt are going to impact their entire lives?
It's a very difficult question to answer. Social scientists have a set of tools that they can use to sort of tease out these effects in a way that gets at the causal relationship a little bit better than some of the research that we've been looking at so far on this question. People are really just starting to talk about this in the research community. I think we're going to see an emergence of some new work in this area. I'm hoping that it will have a little bit more robust evidence that can bring to bear on this discussion.
Beth Akers is a fellow in the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Public Policy, and her recent piece on the Brown Center chalkboard is entitled Why Easing Education Debt Won't Necessarily Help the Economy. With that title in mind, Beth, we say it won't necessarily help the economy, but could it help the economy to ease education debt?
So it's my opinion that we do have a very large positive effect coming out of student debt in the sense that it is enabling higher investment in education. And so we see that people on average are coming out ahead in terms of lifetime incomes because of they've taken on this debt. My question is, you know, in terms of the negative side of debt, is what is it causing people to do in terms of the psychological response? So, you know, we can see empirically that people have more than enough income to offset the increases in debt that they've taken on, but that doesn't rule out the case that people are potentially acting differently than they would if they didn't have this debt. That has nothing to do with the financial constraints that are imposed by the debt. So to me, this is going to be the really interesting question moving forward. It's what is the psychological burden of carrying debt over a long period of time, and how does that play into policy formation in this area?
Beth, in your piece, you write, and I'll quote, debt relief amounts to a transfer of wealth from one group to another, which means that while one group benefits, another pays the price. Who would pay the price if student debt is relieved?
So it depends, of course, how this is financed. The most obvious way is to raise taxes. And so we have a very complex tax code. It's not immediately obvious who's paying the price here. But what we can say pretty clearly is who would benefit from this. And if you look at the population of people with student loan debt, it's actually the more affluent people who have more debt. And this is somewhat surprising, but not if you think twice about it, because it's the folks who invest a lot in education who have a lot of student loan debt. And these people also have on average, higher earnings because of that education. So if we're going to raise the money to pay for debt relief through taxes, we're transferring money from the more well-off population who pay more taxes to a relatively well-off population who have student loan debt. So that's not to say that there aren't people who, you know, should be receiving these transfers, but you know, just taking a look at the population of people with student loan debt and identifying them as a needy population is really the wrong calculation.
What does this piece of yours, what do you think it says to students and to the parents who are paying for that college or university education, whether they're writing checks or they're taking out loans or a mix of both? What do I take away from your piece?
I think what some folks should take away from this, the narrative about debt being a problem, being a crisis situation, has really sort of overwhelmed the public discussion about debt. You know, I often hear people upset about their debt situation, even though they are someone who has really benefited from the access of, you know, of this credit. So I think what it does is really allows people to think of the decision to take on debt and to pay for their education in a different framework. And so recognizing those benefits as well as those costs may people have a sort of a different tone when it comes to this.
So am I hearing you say perhaps don't fear student debt as much as we think we fear it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really big concern of mine. You know, we've built up this very negative narrative about student loan debt. We know that there are certain populations of students who don't go to college because they have fear about debt. And by continuing to talk about it in this negative light, we're only exacerbating that problem. So we want people to be cognizant of the trade-offs they make when they take on debt, but we don't want people to be afraid of it in a way that's not justified.
Beth Akers is a fellow in the Brookings Institution's Brown Center on Public Policy. She focuses on the economics of education, and her piece for the Brown Center chalkboard on their website is Why Easing Education Debt Won't Necessarily Help the Economy. Thank you so much for talking with us, Beth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Shelley Manis will tell you she's a hard worker. She works 60 to 80 hours per week as a lecturer at the University of Michigan's Sweetland Center for Writing. She also spends her time helping local theaters develop plays. And the first time she took a vacation in the past 14 years happened this summer. Manis is also in debt for her student loans to the tune of $180,000. After undergraduate school, she worked for several years in the publishing industry, but she felt like she wasn't learning anymore, so she pursued a master's in dramatic literature and then a PhD in theater history.
By the time I left the PhD, I had about $160,000 in debt, but because the payment plan is so impossible for the amount that I have, I now have $180,000, and that last $20,000 is probably all interest. I think about money every single day. There's not, and multiple times a day, actually. There are days when I'm afraid to look at my bank account. There are days when I'm already thinking ahead about, oh, I need to contact the federal loan people again and let them know I still can't do this and try to figure something out. Every day.
Manis says the psychological burden of long-term debt is huge.
It feels almost like a bigger price than the actual price tag in a lot of ways. I'm 39 years old. I'm highly educated. I'm capable. I work really hard. I have no savings. If an emergency were to happen, thank goodness I have my parents who now can say, okay, we'll jump in and help. But I resent that. I resent it. I feel ashamed of it. I feel like I'm less than, and it's really upsetting on a daily basis.
Manis said she understood the debt would take a long time to pay off, and she knew she was entering a tough job market. But she figured she'd graduated from one of the top programs in her field and thought she would get a tenured position and be able to quickly begin paying off her loans. But that has not been the case.
The one thing that I would want listeners to know is that most people who have a really large amount or any amount of student debt are not people who are wasting time. They are not people who are lazy, and they are not people who don't want to pay the debt back, but there aren't easy enough ways to do it. You can fall between the cracks so easily. I think it's just impossible.
Recent developments in Washington could help people like Shelley Manis pay off their loans. She qualifies for a student loan forgiveness program. That means if she works for a public institution for 10 years and makes her payments on time, her loans will be forgiven. If not, Manis expects she'll be paying back her student loans for the rest of her life. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was directed today by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Kyle Norris, Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.